Okay, listen, tonight I'd like to begin a new book in the Old Testament. I'd like to begin this book of Esther. It's right after the book of Nehemiah. It's right before the book of Job. The book of Esther, I think, gosh, it's probably been 20 years since we've been through this book. It's been a long time. But this book is pretty unique in a lot of ways. First of all, there's a lot of people who don't even know why this book was even put in the canon or scripture. Because for one thing, the name of God is never even mentioned in this book. God's never even mentioned. It's kind of like the Song of Solomon. God was never mentioned in that book, and yet that book was saturated with God from cover to cover, as far as I was concerned. This book has that same kind of criteria about it as far as not mentioning God and not mentioning prayer. But at the same token, you can see the hand of God working through this book and working through Esther and working through her uncle Mordecai and working in such a way that it really demonstrates to me very conclusively that God's providence is always being extended towards his people, and especially the Jews. And one of the things that to me is testimony to the fact that there is a God and that the Bible is his word is the Jew. By all the laws of men and nations, the Jew should not be in existence today. They really should not even be in existence. I mean, nation after nation after nation after nation, you go through the list of nations throughout the Bible that have gone up against Israel, and these nations were much more powerful, and they were much larger, much bigger. The Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Jebusites and the Hittites, and I'm talking about the Moabites and the Ammonites and the Amalekites. And how many of us have ever seen a Babylonian? Have you seen a Babylonian? Yet they were one of the most powerful nations on earth. Have you ever seen a Philistine? They were one of the most powerful people. You know, these were the sworn enemies of Israel, along with the Assyrians and so many others. All these other nations have gone by the wayside, and they are no more. They are extinct. And yet all of them have tried desperately to extinguish the Jew, to wipe him off the face of the earth. And look at today, the Jews are at the very center of the world, just the way Zechariah prophesied at the end times. He said that Israel would become a burdensome stone to the whole world. That's exactly what she is. You can hardly open up the paper or watch the news without seeing Israel in the center of the world. And it's a stone that's not going to be moved. But yet so many nations that surround her want nothing more than to be able to pick her up and throw her into the sea and to utterly destroy her. Israel has been hated from her inception by one nation, or one person, one group of people after another. Look at the Palestinians. They absolutely abhor Israel. Look at all the Arab nations. Look at all the Muslims. They hold them in contempt with this infernal malice that just defies explanation if you do not look at things from a spiritual perspective. Before I became a Christian, I used to take some of the philosophy classes, and in one of my philosophy classes, they were talking about Hitler and the Jews and how he slaughtered 6 million of them and so on and so forth. And it always intrigued me. It always, piqued my curiosity as to why has there been such malice towards the Jews. I never could figure that out. I never was chummy with any Jews that I can remember in my life. I just could not figure out how come these people were so hated. It just never seemed to add up to me until I became a Christian, and then I understood why they are hated by so many people throughout history. And that's because we're in a spiritual warfare where the devil absolutely hates the Jewish people. He hates all men. He hates all nations. Believe me, he's an equal opportunity hater. He hates all men because every human being is created in the image and likeness of God. And he holds all men in contempt because he holds God in contempt. But he has a special malice and hatred and venom towards the Jew, because it's through the Jews that we got our Bible. It's through the Jews that God revealed himself to man. And it's through the Jews that Jesus Christ was born. That it's through the Jews that we have got our salvation. I mean, that's why he just hates them to no end. And so this book has to deal with how God protected the Jews when they were exiled from their land into Medo-Persia. At first, they were exiled into Babylon, if you remember how God chastised them, threw them out of the land because of their disobedience. Then they went to Babylon, but then they were there, you know, for a number of years until the Medes and the Persians took over Babylon. So this is where this story kind of takes off, is where this is the number of Jews that are living in Medo-Persia at this time. And prior to this, there was a number of Jews, if you read the book of Ezra, which we're going to be going through probably when we finish up this one, but in Ezra there was a decree that went forth under Cyrus that the Jews could go back to their homeland. And some 50,000 Jews did go back to their homeland. And after they were back in their homeland, about 70 years later, then another group of Jews went back to their homeland in Israel, in Jerusalem. Well, in between that two waves of immigrants coming back into their homeland, this story unfolds, all right? And in this story, there's this king, and his name is Ahasuerus, but in many Bibles, his name is referred to as Xerxes. The names are interchangeable, but I think what Ahasuerus really means is a title. It's like president. If they say King Ahasuerus, it's almost like saying Mr. President, all right? Because his name was Xerxes, but sometimes he went by that title of Ahasuerus. So sometimes it may seem like a little bit confusing when you read this. This is just a little bit of a background what I'm giving you so that you can see what I'm talking about when we go through this book. I mean, nobody knows for sure who wrote this book. It's speculated by, you know, Jewish tradition that maybe Mordecai, who's the main character in this book, had written this book. It was written around 465, 450 BC, somewhere around in there. I mean, we don't even know exactly when it was written, because then we don't even know exactly who wrote the book. But that's just a basic overview. And what I'd like to do, if we have the time tonight, I'd like to just read through the first three chapters. We'll take one chapter at a time, because it's a story that begins to unfold. And there's 10 chapters, so there's no way we can read the whole book tonight. All right? But as the story unfolds, you begin to see the providence of God and the hand of God and how he protects his people. Beginning with verse 1 in chapter 1 in the book of Esther, it says, "Now it took place in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces." So get this kind of picture. This is this guy, he reigned from Ethiopia. You can't even see it on his map here. It's the tip of Africa all the way to, you know, the tip of India. So, I mean, he was ruling over all these lands, and there was 127 different provinces or territories or jurisdictions that were under his control. So, I mean, so he was quite a powerful man, and he was the king of the Medo-Persians. Now, keep something in mind when we go through this, because I'd like to just throw this in so you can keep this picture in your mind. Remember when Nebuchadnezzar had this vision, this dream, rather, of this huge stature of a man. And then the stature of man, the head was made of gold, and the arms and the chest were made of silver. And then the belly and the thighs were made of bronze. And then the legs were made of iron, and the feet were made of iron and clay. Well, Daniel interpreted this dream to Nebuchadnezzar, and he said, "Nebuchadnezzar, you are that head of gold, okay? And after you, there will come another kingdom, which will be inferior to you, all right? And that kingdom is the Medo-Persian kingdom. You know, it was the Medes and the Persians. Just like, you know, it's interesting, this statue, it has two arms, okay? This, and the two arms represents that this is two kingdoms that were ruling as one, the Medo-Persians. Well, this King Ahasuerus was king over this particular kingdom. But Daniel said that this kingdom would be inferior to Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, which is Babylon. And the reason they were inferior is because Nebuchadnezzar was like God. In other words, what he said, nobody, no law, no judge, nobody at all could oppose him. And if he would have, let's say, write something into law, if he just on a whim just decided, well, I'm going to change that, he could change it, because he was the supreme ruler of the known world. So he was that head of gold. But now, in the Medes and the Persians, it's kind of an inferior kingdom, because now the king is not the supreme being. What is the most important thing now is the law of the Medes and the Persians. Anything they sign into law, even the king himself could not revoke that law. Remember when we went through the book of Daniel and we read about Daniel in the lion's den? All right, and there was that King Darius. King Darius was a king of the Medes and the Persians. Well, they conned him into signing this stupid decree that said that if anybody worships any other god or gives homage to any other god for the next 30 days, he is to be thrown to the lions. And so he was a kind of a empty-headed individual thought, well, this is a good idea, and he signed it into law. Well, then when he found out that Daniel, you know, was praying to his God three times a day, and then Daniel was going to be thrown to the lions, the king couldn't do anything about it. He was really beside himself. He couldn't even sleep that night. I mean, he was just worried sick over Daniel being thrown to the lions. And remember, so because the law of the Medes and Persians superseded the authority of the king, Daniel was thrown into the lion's pit. And it was the next day, Darius runs down there and says, Daniel, did you, God save you? He says, yeah, the lions didn't touch me. So they pulled him up, and the guys that were, you know, that tried to get him killed, they and their kids were thrown into the lion's den, and they were devoured before they even hit the ground. So I just kind of give you that insight or that background a little bit so you can see what I'm talking about. It went from Babylon to Medo-Persia. Now we're talking about this king of Medo-Persia. But he's ruling this vast territory that includes 127 provinces. And so he says in verse 2, he says, in those days, King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which was in Susa, the capital. Now you can't even see it on his map because it's tore off on the ends there. But it says, in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all the, his princes in attendance and the army of officers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of his provinces, being in his presence, when he displayed his riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty for many days, 180 days. And when these days were completed, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days for all the peoples who were present in Susa, the capital, from the greatest to the least, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were hangings of fine linen and violet linen, and held by cords of fine purple linen on silver rings and marble columns, and couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry and marble and a mother of pearl and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels of various kinds, and the royal wine was plentiful according to the king's bounty. And the drinking was done according to the law. There was no compulsion, for so the king had given orders to each official of his household that he should do according to his desires of each person. Now let me just explain something here when we're reading this. When I first read this story, and I thought, well, 180 days of partying? This is what they're throwing a party. The last 180 days, I'm going to talk about a half a year here, 6 months of just, you know, throwing this big, huge bash. Well, keep something in mind, because after doing a lot of different reading and a lot of different commentaries, and you read some of the works of Herodias, the historian, and Josephus, the historian, you get more of an understanding of what this is all about. History has borne us out that Ahasuerus, otherwise known as Xerxes, what his intention was to get all of the nobles and all of the governors and all the ruling authorities over those 127 provinces. He brought them there to Susa, the capital of Medo-Persia. And the reason why he entertained them for 180 days was because he wanted to get their support behind him, because his intention was to have a huge army go up against the Greeks. He wanted to settle some old scores with the Greeks. And history bears this out, that he was going to go to war with the Greeks. So he threw this party. And what this party was, it was basically he was taking all of his officials and all of these governors and these satraps and whatnot. And he was wining and dining them for the purpose of getting them to go along with his military plans. But at the same token, he was making a lot of military plans, and he was showing them, you know, what he wanted to do, and he's always trying to get their backing. But at the same time, you know, it goes to great lengths to just show even his wealth here, because if you're reading about, like, in verse 6, and there were hangings of fine white and violet linen held by cords of fine purple and linen or silver and rings and marble columns. I mean, he's just giving you an idea that this guy was really showing off to all of these different rulers and governors and satraps and people who are in charge of these 127 provinces, to show them that he could really support a huge military campaign. That was his intention there. I mean, history kind of brings this out. But of course, when you read it in this book, you don't get that idea. But anyway, after the 180 days were up, then he throws a seven-day party. And I think the primary reason for the seven-day party was to throw it for all of his officials in his palace, all right, in the citadel themselves. He was just almost like a thank-you party for all of his servants and all of his nobles and everybody there that had gone along with his program in terms of entertaining all these other officials. So when he's having this big bash, this is what it says here in that verse 8. It says, and the drinking was done according to the law. There was no compulsion for so the king had given orders to each official of his household that he should do according to the desires of each person. And he says, in verse 9, it says, Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Meumen, Biztha, and Harbona, and Bigtha, and Bagtha, and Zethar, and Carcass, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of the king Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown, in order to display her beauty to the people and the princes, for she was beautiful. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command by the eunuchs. Then the king became very angry, and his wrath burned within him. Then the king said to the wise men who understood the times, for it was a custom of the king to speak before all who knew law and justice and were close to him, Karshina, Shethar, Damatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marcina, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media, who had access to the king's presence and sat in the first place in the kingdom. According to the law, what is to be done with Queen Vashti because she did not obey the command of the king Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs? And in the presence of the king and the princes, Memucan said, Queen Vashti has wronged not only the king, but also all the princes and all the people who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, causing them to look with contempt on their husbands by saying, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought into his presence, but she did not come. And this day the ladies of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's conduct will speak in the same way to all the king's princes, and there will be plenty of contempt and anger. And if it pleases the king, let the royal edict be issued by him, and let it be written in the law of Persia and Media, so that it cannot be repealed, that Vashti should come no more in the presence of King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is more worthy than she. And when the king's edict, which she shall make, is heard throughout all the kingdom, great as it is, then all the women will give honor to their husbands, great and small. And this word pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. So he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province according to its script, and to every people according to their language, that every man should be the master of his whole own house, and the one who speaks in the language of his own people. Now, just breaking this down just a little bit, I think it's kind of self-explanatory, but what happened there is at the end of the 7 days, what happened is the king was over there having a big bash for all of the people of his palace, basically, both great and small, and his queen was throwing a big party for all the women. And I don't know, if you look over there in Persia today, which is modern-day Iran, and a lot of these Mideastern countries, there still seems to be almost a situation where the men are separated from the women, especially in prayers and things like this. And this goes way, way back, okay? So the men were having their party and the women were having their party. But the king, after 7 days, he was feeling a little tipsy, a little intoxicated, and he decided, well, I'm going to show off my wife to all these people. So he sent his eunuchs over there to her party and said, hey, put on your royal crown and your robes and come over here. I want to show you off. And she just didn't want to have any part of this. You know, a bunch of guys drooling and giving their cat calls and whistles and stuff like that when she prayed her up and down. So she said, forget it, I'm not going. And then when it got back to the king, I mean, he was livid. He was just absolutely beside himself. He was so ticked off. But then he consults his advisors. There's seven of them here that are mentioned. They're kind of like his cabinet or his close associates who were very versed as far as Medo-Persian law was concerned. So he asked him, what am I supposed to do here? So this guy, the spokesman for the seven, his name is Memucan. He decided, well, this is what we got to do. You know, this woman has not only insulted the king, but if the word gets out, it's going to kind of give a green light to all women to just insult their husbands. So this is what you got to do. You got to issue a decree where it will forbid Queen Vashti to ever see your face again, and you are to depose her as a queen. And, you know, he was, like I said, he was a little tipsy at the time, and, you know, he thought, well, this would be a good idea. And then they said, well, if you do that, then the word's going to go out, and all the women are going to respect their husbands, and, you know, they're not going to be in this kind of stuff going on. If you read that verse 20 and the latter part of that verse 22, and it says, and the king's edict, which he shall make, is heard throughout all the kingdom, great as it is, then all women will give honor to their husbands, and great and small. And that latter part of that verse 22, that every man should be the master of his own household. And, you know, I think those are my favorite verses, aren't they, for you? I mean, anyway, it went out. This was basically the plan. to keep these women in line. So that he sent out this edict. But then after he sobers up, when we read in chapter 2 here, he kind of has a bit of a change of heart. But it's too late because, like I told you before, once you sign something into law, hey man, that's it. Not even the king can revoke it. So he says in verse 1, in chapter 2, it says, after these things, when the anger of the king Ahasuerus had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's attendants who served him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint overseers in all the provinces of the kingdom, that they may gather every beautiful young virgin to Susa the capital, to the harem, into the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women, and let their cosmetics be given them. Then let the young lady who pleases the king be queen in the place of Vashti. And the matter pleased the king, and he did accordingly. Now there was a Jew in Susa, the capital, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite, who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been exiled from Jeconiah, the king of Judah, and Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. And he was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther. Hadassah was her Jewish name, and then her Persian name was Esther. He says, bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. Now the young lady was beautiful of form and face, and when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So it came about when the command and the decree of the king were heard, and many young ladies were gathered to Susa, the capital, into the custody of Hegai, that Esther was taken to the king's palace into the custody of Hegai, who was in charge of the women. Now the young lady pleased him and found favor with him. So he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and food, and gave her 7 choice maids from the king's palace, and transferred her and her maids to the best place in the harem. Esther did not make known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had instructed her that she should not make them known. And every day Mordecai walked back and forth in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and how she fared. Now when the turn of each young lady came to go into the king Ahasuerus after the end of her 12 months under the regulations for the women, for the days of the beautification were completed as follows: 6 months with the oil of myrrh, 6 months with spices and cosmetics for women. The young lady would go into the king in this way. Anything that she desired was given to her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening she would go in, and in the morning she would return to the second harem, to the custody of Shagaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not again go into the king unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. Now when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, came to go into the king, she did not request anything except that which Hegai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women, devised. And Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to the king Ahasuerus, to his royal palace, in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebet, in the 7th year of his reign. It says, and the king loved Esther more than all women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all of the princes and his servants. He also made a holiday for the provinces and gave gifts according to the king's bounty. And when the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, and Esther had not yet made known her kindred of her people, even as Mordecai had commanded her. For Esther did what Mordecai told her, as she had done when under his care. In those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's officials from those who guarded the door, became angry and sought to lay hands on the king Ahasuerus. But the plot became known to Mordecai, and he told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. Now when the plot was investigated and found to be so, they were both hanged on the gallows, and it was written in the book of Chronicles in the king's presence. Now let's just back up. We're going to go through this, kind of break it down a little bit. I think it was necessary to just read the whole chapter rather than break it up to explain it, but keep a couple things in mind. Now, as the story begins to develop and begins to unfold, you can begin to see now the hand of God beginning to work in the situation because of what they're about to experience as far as being Jews. But anyway, a couple of things to keep in mind. When they found out the king was kind of down and out, once he sobered up and he realized, well, I got rid of my queen, I can't even see her anymore because of the law, well, you know, his counselors decided, well, I'll tell you what we'll do. Let's just find all the most beautiful women in your whole kingdom. You know, the most beautiful ones we can find, virgins, women, we'll bring them into your harem, and then you can select a queen from them. And, you know, he thought that was a great idea. And, of course, I think these guys came up with that idea because once the king found himself really kind of despondent over the law that he signed into being, these advisors of his probably were a little on edge, kind of thinking, uh-oh, you know, now he's really mad, you know, so what were they going to do to kind of appease him? So anyway, they came up with this idea, this plan. And this plan was for 6 months, they would go through one beauty treatment, and then 6 months, another beauty treatment before they were even going to go to the king. But what's kind of interesting, if you go all the way back to the beginning of this book, in chapter 1, verse 3, it talks about this is in the third year of the reign of Ahasuerus or Xerxes, you know, he threw this big party. Well, then we read over here that it wasn't until the seventh year that Esther was crowned queen. Keep a couple things in mind. If you read historical accounts and secular accounts of you know, the Persian Wars that were written by Herodotus and also some of the things that were written by Josephus, what we find is that I think that shortly after he exiled Queen Vashti, that's when Xerxes or Ahasuerus went to war with the Greeks. And so he was gone for quite a length of time in these wars. And unfortunately, he really got defeated soundly in these wars. It was a couple of battles that he met his Waterloo, so to speak, and then he kind of came back with his tail between his legs. So about a year later, I mean, these women had finished up their beauty treatments. And, you know, I guess the old saying, the more things change, the more they remain the same. I mean, you go back thousands of years and a great deal of emphasis was put upon a woman's beauty. Well, nothing's really changed. I think that's because simply that's the way God made men. He made them visual. And that's, I don't see a whole lot of difference. Like, we could look back on this and say, well, you know, these women were pretty, had it pretty tough, which they probably did as far as being used like cattle. But I can't help when I read this to see a kind of reflection of the same thing. And all you have to do is look at any magazine rack and you will see cover after cover after cover after cover, one gorgeous woman after another. The whole emphasis in our society is on physical appearance, on what you look like on the outside. And nothing's changed. 1,000 years have come and gone. It's the same thing. But, you know, if you read in 1 Peter chapter 3, what does he say? He says, hey, man, don't let your beauty be external only. You know, he said that the braiding of the hair and the putting on jewelry and the putting on the makeup and the putting on dresses, he says, but let your beauty be the hidden person of the heart, this quiet, gentle spirit of the heart, because he says that is precious in the sight of God and man. And he says, and some of your husbands who may be disobedient to the word, they're going to be won over without you having to nag them if you just show this quiet, gentle spirit. So when you read this, what I see is this, is that Esther was not only gorgeous, she was not only beautiful. I mean, she was a number 10, she was a knockout, but there was something about her that went much deeper than this, than skin deep, because her eunuch, Hege, I mean, he saw it in her immediately. And he said, wow, this woman has really got some class. This woman has really got some charm. This woman is really head above everybody else. And it wasn't just simply her beauty. I think there was a lot in her character. You could surmise from what we read as far as what Mordecai had said to her and as far as her upbringing that she was a godly woman. And as the story unfolds, you begin to see more and more of this as far as her character is concerned. So anyway, long story short, she's the one that came in and found tremendous favor with the king, and then he ends up crowning her his queen and then throwing this big, huge bash to celebrate this party. But it's an interesting thing the way that he would do it. They got all these beautiful women, and then every night he would get a different woman. She'd go to him at night, and it says whatever she wanted to take, she could take into the king. In other words, whatever apparel she wanted to wear, whatever cosmetics she wanted to put on, whatever jewelry she wanted to get, whatever she wanted, she could have to go into the king. And yet it says here that Esther didn't take anything except what Hege had told her. And Hege probably said, hey, listen, you know, you got a lot of natural beauty here. You don't need to put on a dog. You don't need 8 pounds of makeup, man. Just go in the way you are. So she just followed his advice, and the king went head over heels for her. And everybody that saw her just saw this girl really stood out. She was really special. And I know that just from reading this, I can surmise that her beauty went much deeper than just the physical, because she had something in her character that I think Peter talked about as far as the hidden person of the heart. Anyway, the king basically makes her a queen, but then he's got this whole harem too. So, you know, this guy, you know, he's got a lot of variety that he could choose from. If he gets tired of one, he could hit the other. It's too bad for these women in a way, because it says here all of them went into this harem, and then when he would have sexual relations with them, and then they'd leave in the morning. If he didn't care for them, they'd never heard from him again, but they couldn't leave his harem. They had it tough, but then I read about his eunuchs, and I think, well, they must have had it tougher, because a eunuch, you know, they get castrated, so they won't be fooling around with the king's wives and his concubines. So, I mean, that was the day and age they lived in. You just get kind of an overview of what's taking place here before we go into chapter 3. Anybody have any questions or anything they want to add or share to what we read here? All right, well, anyway, in chapter 3, we read about this Mordecai now. He's the main figure of the story. Now, this Mordecai, he's a Jew. Keep a couple of things in mind. It says here that it talks about his lineage. It talks about, if you read this verse 5 and 6, it says in this chapter 2, talking about Mordecai. He says, now there was a Jew in Susa, the capital, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been exiled with Jeconiah, the king of Judah, from Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. Now keep something in mind. When you read this, obviously it's not saying that Mordecai was the one who was taken from Jerusalem and exiled under this king Jeconiah, from Nebuchadnezzar. And the reason I say this is because this story that we're reading took place over 100 years after this exile. So it's what it's doing is just giving you the lineage or genealogy of his parents, his grandparents, great-grandparents, who ended up being deported, okay? And that's how Mordecai ended up being exiled himself, because he was born in exile. That's basically what it's saying here. And then, of course, what it's saying also is that Esther was his cousin. He was much older than her, and he ended up raising her as his own daughter, right? And you could tell that Mordecai was a godly man, and I think he imparted this fear of God and this love of God into Esther. And that's one of the things that I think shown through as far as her character. Anyway, beginning with chapter 3, we're just going to finish this chapter 3 tonight and comment on it, and then we're just going to go ahead and close, because there's no way that we can finish the story. This is 10 chapters, and it really starts getting involved as the plot thickens here. In verse 1 in chapter 3, it says, after these events, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agite, and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, why are you transgressing the king's command? Now it was when they had spoken daily to him and he would not listen to them that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's reason would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage to him, Haman was filled with rage, and he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, Pur, that is the lot, was cast before Haman from day to day and from month to month until the 12th month, that is the month of Adar. Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of the kingdom. Their laws are different from from those of all other peoples, and they do not observe the king's laws. So it is not in the king's interest to let them remain. If it is pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business to put into the king's treasuries. Then the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agite, and the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, "The silver is yours, and the people also. Do with them as you please." Then the king's scribes summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and it was written just as Haman commanded to the king's satraps, to the governors who were over each province, and to the princes of each people, each province according to its script, each people according to its language, being written in the name of the king Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring. And the letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to seize the possessions as plunder. A copy of the edict is to be issued as law in every province, as published to all the people, so that they should be ready for this day. The couriers went out impelled by the king's command while the decree was issued in Susa, the capital, and while the king and Haman sat down to drink, the city of Susa was in confusion. Now, here's the situation, I think, as it begins to unfold. I think it's kind of significant. Now, another character comes on the scene. His name is Haman. All right. Now, he says he's a Gaite. In other words, some of the Jews, even today, they believe that if you trace back the genealogy of Mordecai, he was a descendant of King Saul. And if you trace back this guy, Haman, they said that Agag was the king that Samuel ended up slaying, and he was an Amalekite. Amalek was the head of the Amalekites, and what happened was when the God's people were coming into the Promised Land, in other words, when they were wandering through the desert, what happened there was the Amalekites began to attack God's people. It says they attacked the stragglers, you know, the weak and the lame and the ones who were, you know, taking up the rear of this procession of all of these people that were marching through the desert. It says that Amalek, or the Amalekites, attacked them. All right, and so God, and if you read it in 1 Samuel, what it says is that when Saul became king, then God gave him instructions through Samuel that he was to go destroy all the Amalekites because of what they did to God's people when they were going through the desert. Long story short, Saul went out there. He killed almost all the Amalekites, but he was given specific instructions. Nothing was to be taken for personal use. Everything was contraband. Everything was under the ban. Everything was to be given dedicated to God. But what happened was that, you know, the people, they talked Saul into keeping some of the sheep and some of the cattle and whatnot, and they kept the best for themselves. And he didn't kill the king, which was Agag. When Samuel, you know, saw what had happened, he told Saul, "Hey, look, you know, you blew it. You didn't obey God's command, so he's going to take away the kingdom from you, and you're no longer going to be the king. He's going to give it to another." And Samuel said to Saul, he says that rebellion is a sin of witchcraft, and disobedience is really an affront to God. Because even though Saul obeyed partially, he didn't obey all the way. As far as God was concerned, he disobeyed. And so, long story short, the Jews today believe that what happened was that this Haman was a descendant of this king, and that Mordecai was a descendant of Saul. Now, I don't really think that that was the case, a lot of the reading that I've been doing, but it's possible. And all I'm saying, if it is, well, then this is the final showdown between Amalek and the Jew, all right, between Mordecai and Haman. And Haman, what happens here, he is promoted to basically being prime minister of, you know, the Medes and the Persians, of all of this territory. And then what? It all goes right to his head. And so whenever anybody sees Haman walking around, they bow the knee, they get down, they do him homage. And Mordecai won't do it. And it says here, when we read, I think it's the end of chapter 2, if I'm not mistaken, that what happened was that once Esther became queen, Mordecai apparently was promoted as a kind of a judge, an official that would judge the people, because he said he sat at the gate. That was the place where basically the politicians of the day, or the people who were, you know, in the government authority, would settle people's problems. So anyway, he was an official now because of Esther. And he would not bow his knee to Haman. And then when the other people were asking him, hey, how come you're not doing this? He says, well, because I'm a Jew. And this is my take on it. I could be wrong about this. He's kind of speculative. I'm sure that Mordecai wouldn't have a problem with bowing down to the king, because you could read on all different portions of Scripture in the Old Testament how people bowed down to those in authority over them. It didn't mean that they were worshiping them. It was just that they were showing a great deal of respect. But Haman, apparently, when he wanted people to do homage to him, it was far more than just simply a respect that they were to show for his position. It went far beyond that, because Mordecai could see that this guy, you know, thinks he's God, and I'm not going to give him, you know, that kind of worship that he wants. And so anyway, long story short, the word gets back to him, and then he's infuriated. Okay, and then he decides, well, I'm not just going to kill him. I'm going to kill all the Jews. I'm going to have them all done in. And you know what I see here, and I don't want to torture this or read too much into it, but to me, Haman, you know what he represents today? He represents the state in this respect. If you read this, look at this. Well, begin with that verse 5. It says, when Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage to him, Haman was filled with rage, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. And then when he talks to the king, this is what he says. He says to the king in verse 8, he says, then Haman said to the king Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different. Now, when you read this, just envision that who he's talking about is Christians in our day and age. All right, because I think there's a real strong application when it says here that Haman said to the king Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of all other people, and they do not observe the king's laws. So it is not in the king's interest to let them remain. This is where we're at today. We are the ones that are being silenced. It's not anybody else. If we speak up and say, you know what, God said that's wrong. God said that's sin. God said if you do that, you're going to go to hell. God said, you know, if you stand up and say those kind of things, all right, you are labeled as being extremist. You are labeled as a fanatic. You are labeled as intolerant, as hateful, as bigoted. You know, the whole litany goes on and on and on of what we're called, right? Well, you see this in this situation with Haman and the Jews when it begins to unfold. Anyway, just kind of winding this down. What happened is that now he signs this decree. Look at the decree he signs. Now, once this decree is signed, it can't be revoked. Okay, look at the decree, because it says here in verse 9, if it is pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business to put into the king's treasuries. Now, 10,000 talents of silver, I mean, that's over $20 million. I mean, and obviously Haman didn't have that kind of money, but I think what his intention was that he was just going to confiscate it from all the Jews that are going to be murdered. Now, it's been estimated that there was something like 15 million Jews at this particular time. They weren't just in Medo-Persia. They were just scattered all over the place, including some of them had already gone back to Jerusalem under Zerubbabel. All right, they had already gone back there. So at the time, I mean, there were millions of Jews. I don't know if there were that many. But if there were, then we're talking about a man who was out to destroy more people than Hitler got destroyed, all right? Even if it was just half that, even if it was 7 or 8 million, I mean, still a lot of people that were going to be destroyed, men, women, and children. He was just going to annihilate them all right? Now you see this kind of contempt, this kind of hatred that is manifested towards the Jews. I mean, it goes back thousands of years, almost from their inception. You see this hatred. And why is there such hatred? You got to look beyond the physical. This infernal malice comes from a demonic source, all right? Because the Bible says we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but these spiritual forces of wickedness that are in heavenly places. And I'm telling you, the Jews are absolutely hated, you know, throughout the world. And towards the end of the world, I mean, in the last 7 years, especially mid-tribulation, when the Antichrist sets up his image and his statue in the rebuilt temple, declares himself to be God, even Jesus himself said, hey man, pray that that day does not happen to be on a Sabbath, and pray that you're not nursing children or are pregnant at the time, because the persecution of the Jews then is just going to be horrendous, and the Jews throughout the world are going to be persecuted like you're not going to believe under this final Haman, this final Hitler, this final hater of the Jews. And you see that the Arabs, how they hate the Jews, they just hold them in utmost contempt. But you got to look beyond the scenes and what's behind it. What's behind Haman's hatred toward the Jews? It's demonic. He doesn't even know it. And I look at this king. It says here, in verse 10, it says, "Then the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, 'The silver is yours, and the people also, do with them as you please.'" Look what it says here in verse 12 and 13. It says, "Then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the month. And it was written just as Haman commanded the king's satraps and the governors who were over each province, and to the princes of each people, and to the province according to his script, each people according to his language, being written in the name of the king Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring." Now, you remember how they arrived at being the 13th day? You go back and to that verse 7. All right. It says, "In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus." Now, Pur is the dice. Pur is the lot. All right. It's like throwing dice. That's what Pur means. It says, "It is the lot was cast before Haman on that day to day from month to month until the 12th month." That is the month of Adar. Now, here's the thing. Here, keep this in mind. What happened here is that Haman decided he's going to destroy the Jews. So he went to the astrologers and the conjurers. He went to the diviners, the fortune tellers. He went to the people who are steeped in the black arts. And he said, listen, he went to them and says, "I want to destroy these people, but I want to know when would be the most appropriate time to do it. When would be the best time to do it?" And so they cast lots. They cast it. They said, "We'll find out what would be the best month." So they cast the lots, and they come up with the 12th month. And they cast lots again, and they came up with the 13th day. So when we're reading here, it says when he did it, it was the first month. So in other words, it wasn't going to take place for a whole year. All right, the slaughter of the Jews. So based on that, he comes up with this decree. And if you read the verse 12, it says, "Then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and it was written just as Haman commanded the king's satraps, to the governors who were over each of the provinces, to the princes of each people, each language, being written in the name of the king Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring. And the letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to seize their possessions as plunder. A copy of the edict is to be issued as law in every province and published to all the people so that they should be ready for this day." The couriers went out impelled by the king's commandment while the decree was issued in Susa, the capital. While the king and Haman sat down to drink, the city of Susa was in confusion. Now, as the story unfolds, you begin to get it more and more of a picture of what's going on here. Haman came up with the day and the month would be the most appropriate time. Then he had this thing signed into law. Once it was signed into law, I'm sure he was just rubbing his hands saying, "Oh man, now it's a done deal. Ain't nothing stopping it, because not even the king can change this law." Because like I said, it's the laws of the Medes and the Persians. And that became the absolute authority. No one could then revoke that law, or rescind that law, or ignore that law. So he figured, I got the Jews by the throat. He was going to kill them all, men, women, and children. Now look at the king. According to some of the historians like Herodias and Josephus, well, Herodias, he talks about an incident in Ahasuerus or Xerxes' life to show the kind of brutal man this guy was. I mean, history kind of paints him as kind of an incompetent man. He inherited the throne from his father, Darius, and he didn't really work for it, but he was a really hot-tempered man, and he was a very cruel man. You see a situation here. He just signed into law destroying a whole nation of people, and he sits down with Haman to have a drink. And while they're having a drink, everybody's thrown in confusion when they hear this law, especially the Jews, man. They're just going, "Oh, what the world? That's going to be the end of us in a year." Okay, so they're all kind of in a panic while these two sit down and have cocktails. One of the things that I read about this king Ahasuerus or Xerxes, is that when he was on his campaign to destroy Greece, he came into one of the provinces where there was a very wealthy individual who contributed great sums of money to the military campaign of Ahasuerus or Xerxes. And not only that, he entertained his troops and he gave a lot of money and he did a lot of things for this king. And then the old man said to the king, "I would like to ask you one favor." He says, "I have five sons and I would like to ask you if you would exempt my oldest son from being inscripted or drafted into your army because he needs to take care of me in my old age." And that was a very reasonable request, you know, especially since he contributed so much money to the guy's cause. But the king became infuriated, and he had the man's son just cut in half. And he put half his torso on one side and his legs on the other side of a road, and he had a whole army march between the halves. And he told everybody, he says, "This is what happens to people who are not totally dedicated to my cause and to me." So you see, get an idea of the kind of brutality that was displayed by this man, because it kind of gives you more of an idea when Queen Esther has to deal with him and her fear of what might happen to her if she gets on the bad side of him. You know, this guy, I mean, if he had a bad hair day, man, look out, because he was all over. I mean, this is the kind of temperament he had. Anyway, does anybody have anyone to add or share? We're going to have to close tonight because there's no way we can get through this book. I mean, like I said, it's 10 chapters, but... when the story develops the next three or four chapters, you'll begin to see how God's hand begins to unfold in this and how he takes care of his people. And that, to me, I think is comforting and assuring when you're Christians, that regardless of what happens in your life, that God is orchestrating things and he's in charge of things and everything's going to be working out for his glory, for his honor, for our good, one way or the other.